Hour three of the WGN Radio Theater. My co-host Lisa Wolf and I are here every single Saturday night from 10 p.m. until 3 o'clock in the morning. Five full hours of classic radio. It's such an honor to be on this radio station, broadcasting really across the country. 40-plus states, plus parts of Canada and parts of Mexico can hear our show. We get calls and texts and emails from all over the country. Plus, we have a podcast.
Right, I was just going to say, yeah, we have a podcast you can listen to from anywhere. You can find that at WGNradio.com, or you can find it on our Facebook page. I post it every week at WGN Radio Theater on Facebook.
After this short break, we'll tune into Casey Crime Photographers. Stick around. Welcome back. Hour three of the WGN Radio Theater. Want to remind everyone listening that there are five free classic radio shows waiting for you at 100radioshows.com. Just log on to 100radioshows.com and put your email in, and you will receive an email from us instantly with five free classic radio shows. There are hundreds of additional shows at that website. If you decide to buy any of those shows, make sure that you use the promo code radio at checkout, and you will save 70% on your order. What a way to build your library of classic radio digitally remastered shows and save a whopping 70%. Go to 100radioshows.com. All right, Lisa, you ready for another kind of a amateur detective series?
Well, only if it's Casey Crime Photographer.
It is.
Okay, then
fact,
I'm good.
The character of Jack Flashgun Casey was first seen in pulp novels. Casey was a newspaper cameraman who took crime scene photos. Now, his keen eye for detail served him very well at solving the crimes he was assigned to photograph. While waiting for his next assignment, he killed time with his gal pal Ann Williams at the Blue Note Cafe, run by Ethelbert the bartender. This series came to radio in 1943. It starred Jim Backus. Do you know who Jim Backus is?
I do.
Thurston Howell
III
on Gilligan's Island.
What a great show.
I know. The very first Casey Crime photographer was Jim Backus. Then soon after, Stotz Cotsworth took over and played that role all the way till the end of the series in 1955. It made a transition to television, starring Richard Carlyle and then Darren McGavin in the title role. We have a radio broadcast for you now going back to April 24th, 1947. This is called The Gentle Strangler. It stars Stotz Cotsworth as Casey, crime photographer.
The Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation brings you Crime Photographer.
Gee, it's hot today, Casey. Here it is, only April 24th.
April 24th, the anniversary of Ethelred.
My anniversary, Casey? You know I ain't even married.
I didn't say you, Ethelbert. I said Ethelred, once King of England.
Oh, what's he famous for?
Oh, who knows?
But everyone knows what Anchor Hawking is famous for. Anchor Hawking is the most famous name in glass. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tony Marvin. Every week at this time, the Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation of Lancaster, Ohio, and its more than 10,000 employees bring you another adventure of Casey, crime photographer, ace cameraman who covers the crime news of a great city. Written by Alonzo Dean Cole, our adventure for tonight, The Gentle Strangler. April, spring, around 9 o'clock in the evening. The quiet neighborhoods. From one of these homes, a dignified, white-haired gentleman emerges and strolls leisurely down a tree-lined avenue. A man appears from the shadow of one of the trees and...
Pardon me?
Hmm?
Can I beg the favor of a light?
Light?
I wish to smoke. I have a cigarette and no match.
No, certainly. My lighter...
Thank you. You are Judge Whitcomb, are you not?
Yes.
I've seen your picture in the papers.
Well,
May I walk with you to the next corner?
If you wish.
Good evening, Judge.
Oh, good evening, Dr. Crawford.
Beautiful night.
Lovely, lovely.
Spring is finally here.
Yes, yes.
Spring. The end of winter. The beginning.
I don't recognize you, sir. You live in this neighborhood?
No. I do not live anywhere.
I beg your pardon?
I say, I do not live.
I do not understand.
You will. Because the dead do not live.
The dead?
Yes, Judge Whitcomb. This clump of evergreens here. They are the dense. They cast deep shadows.
Why are you choking me?
You see, Judge, you do not live anymore. You do not live.
Hold it a second, guys, will you? I want to get a shot of you putting that body in the dead wagon.
Okay, Casey.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Slide him in, Jim. Let's go.
Now, Logan, how did old Judge Whitcomb get it, huh?
Oh, the captain's just been telling me you were strangled, Casey, by a person unknown.
Strangled?
Like Assistant District Attorney Dunning got his last week.
And are you newspaper people going to make things sweet for me, Miss Williams, if I don't crack both cases in a hurry?
Well, when big-shot citizens like a judge and an assistant DA aren't safe within a few minutes' walk of their own front doors, pal, there's obviously something wrong someplace.
I'm in no mood for kidding.
Who said I was kidding?
Nuts.
Okay. When was the judge strangled?
About 9 o'clock. He'd started out for his usual evening walk. Shortly after he left his house, Dr. Crawford, who lives in the next block, saw him with a strange man, but except that he was a big guy, and the doc can't give any description of a stranger.
Well, nothing was stolen from the judge, Casey. Apparently, the motive wasn't robbery any more than it was in the Dunning murder.
When a criminal court's judge and an assistant DA get killed within a week of each other, Logan, and are killed the same way...
Sure, it looks as though someone they sent to jail is pulling a payoff.
Well, right? Dunning prosecuted an awful lot of crooks before Judge Whitcomb.
Hundreds, Miss Williams. It won't be easy to figure the particular one who killed them both.
This thing tonight at least looks like a tie-up.
Yeah, the man last seen with the judge is described as big. That's something.
Well, I'm heading downtown to check all cases Dunning prosecuted in Whitcomb's court. Then we'll see how much those somethings are.
Joe, will you take care of that lady over at the table? She wants a glass of half and half that's a third ginger ale. Oh, such people come in here, Miss Williams. They ask for the darndest things.
I'll have another glass of water, pal.
There, you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Your pretzels, Ethelbert, have given him a thirst.
That's the idea of having pretzels on the bar. But a thirst for water don't pay our rent or our license.
I'll tell you what. I'll come in here someday and buy a beer, Ethelbert. That is when the price comes down. Have a pretzel, Annie?
Mind if I do?
While you two are eating up the profits, what's new on them strangling cases?
Don't you read the papers?
Sure I do. And I think it's a crying shame the way they're all picking on Captain Logan. You and Miss Williams told me he ain't got a single clue to work on outside of the idea that Dunning and Judge Whitcomb was killed by the same man.
Yeah, well, that idea's beginning to pay off now, Ethelbert. Logan made an arrest this evening.
He did?
Yep. Yeah.
And it looks as though he has the right man.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, about 8 years ago, Lloyd Dunning prosecuted a crook named Rankin before Judge Whitcomb on a burglary charge and got a conviction. And the judge gave Rankin the limit. Rankin claimed he'd had a raw deal, made a lot of big threats.
He was released from prison just a week before Dunning was strangled. He's a big man, and he has no alibi for the times when the killings took place.
Have another pretzel.
Thanks.
A little more water, Ethelbert.
For both of us.
You know that water's on a meter, don't you? This is becoming an outright swindle.
Hey, you better fill the pretzel bowl up, too. We're touching bottom down here.
Okay, but... Oh, excuse me, there's the bar phone.
His pretzels were saved by the bell, Annie.
Blue Note Cafe, Ethelbert speaking. Yeah, he's right here. Your city editor, Casey.
Uh-oh. All right, give me it.
Take it.
Hello, Burke. Wait a minute. Oh, now, Burke. Well, okay, all right, I got a pencil ready. Go ahead, shoot. Alleyway on Market Street, just south of 12th. I got it. Huh? What happened there? What? We're on our way, Burke, right now.
Wait, say, what is it, Casey?
Another strangling, Annie.
Another?
A detective got it this time, and Rankin didn't do the job. He's locked up in jail.
That corpse was Barney Lennon, Casey. One of my homicide guys and one of the best.
Yes, he was a swell cop, Logan. Swell guy, too. You know, this strangler must be an awfully strong guy. Barney was no pushover.
Well, the strangler must have gotten him unawares.
He must have.
You know, Barney Lennon must have arrested the man whom Dunning prosecuted and Judge Whitcomb sentenced.
Oh, maybe these three stranglings are wholly unrelated. Maybe we're dealing with a maniac.
Well, the killer may be a maniac, Logan, but it's stretching that long arm of coincidence too far to believe that these three jobs are unrelated.
Yes, three law enforcement officers in the same way and within 3 weeks.
Hmm. Yeah. A job a week. The killer may give us proof of relationship, Logan. Next week.
Look, Mr. Candido, never have I offered anyone such a bargain in my shop. An almost new speed graphic camera with a double plasma lens.
Jake, and I need another camera like you need 12 toes.
Dan, sell one of your old ones. I'll make you a trade. If I lose money, so...
if you lost money on a deal, so it'd be a miracle. I'm trading no cameras today.
Yeah, well, say, a man can only try, you know.
Send out that stuff I ordered first thing in the morning, will you?
For you, Mr. Candido, I'll have it delivered as soon as I open the shop.
And don't forget, I need those photo folders especially.
You'll get them. The new business is doing good, huh?
I can't complain.
Mm-hmm. When I think of you running a photographic studio that specializes in taking pictures of little children... I got to live. You who used to be a press photographer taking shots of fires and accidents and political conventions.
It was those conventions that made me decide to leave the newspaper business. Good night, Jake.
Well, I'll take you to the door, then I'm going to lock up and go home myself. There wouldn't be any more business tonight.
Well, that big guy looking in your window may be a customer.
And don't be crazy. He's just a window shopper. I can always tell. Well, good night, Mr. Candido.
Night, Jake. And don't forget that early delivery.
First thing in the morning, you'll get it. I got it all written down.
Nice camera you have in your window.
The best that money can buy, mister.
I'd like to buy one.
You'd like to... Say, well, a man could be wrong.
I beg your pardon?
I was just saying to my last customer that you was only a window shopper. I was going to close up. Oh, come on in.
Thank you. You are the proprietor of this?
That's me. Now, what kind of camera can I show you?
Do you keep other things besides camera?
Anything for taking pictures, I got it.
Where? This store is so small.
I got a big stock room in front.
Before I select the new camera, I had in mind an enlarger.
Well, I got that big stuff in back. Now, what size do you want? Now, bring it out.
To save you the trouble, suppose I go with you and look.
Okay, this way. And what a bargain I can give you. Like none you ever had before in your life. If it's a 4x5 you want, I got an open condenser. And if it's a 5x7, I got an only single projection that
it
would make you...
It is only you I want.
Let go of my coat.
Only you I want. Only you.
This strangling proves we're dealing with a madman, Casey. This Jake Blumberg had nothing to do with the law. He simply ran a little camera shop.
Jake once had something to do with law enforcement, Logan.
Yeah?
What, Casey?
He was the star witness, Annie, in a murder case.
Say, I remember now.
Yeah, I thought you would, pal.
It was his testimony that got that Ivanov girl a death sentence.
Mm-hmm. You remember the rest?
Barney Lennon arrested her. Dunning prosecuted her. Judge Whitcomb sentenced her.
Right.
Casey.
Yeah. I'm the guy who dug up the evidence against her. I must be next on the strangler's list.
With present living costs what they are, Fire King Oven Glass is doubly welcome. One, because Fire King Oven Glass is a product of Anchor Hawking, the world's largest makers of household glass, its cost is incredibly low. And each piece is guaranteed for 2 years against oven breakage. Two, Fire King Oven Glass lets you make delicious, healthful meals out of leftovers of all kinds and out of inexpensive ingredients. And foods baked in Fire King Oven Glass inside the oven retain all their precious vitamins and delicious flavor. So ask for Fire King Oven Glass by name at your favorite chain, variety, hardware, and department store. Beautiful, practical, inexpensive Fire King Oven Glass is a product of Anchor Hawking. The most famous name in glass.
Come on now, talk, Casey. Tell me about this Ivanov case.
Well, okay, Annie. It was before you came to work on the paper.
1939 or 40.
39, Lord. War just started in Europe.
Yeah.
Well, a gal named Irene Ivanov was suspected of poisoning some guy. She handed him a poison cocktail
one night. Casey, what did you have to do with this case?
Casey discovered that Irene Ivanov had bought the poison at Jake Blumberg's camera shop in the form of a chemical used in developing photographs. He got Jake to identify her, and that convinced a jury.
Assistant District Attorney Dunning, Barney Lennon, and I were able to show that the Ivanov dame never even snapped a camera shutter in her life and had no legitimate use for photographic supplies.
Before Judge Whitcomb could sentence her, she committed suicide.
Suicide?
Yep. She got hold of a razor blade in jail and cut her wrists. When her mother heard the news, she had a fatal heart attack, and they were buried together. Now, this Irene was an only child.
But Casey, how does the Strangler tie in with this? You say the Ivanov girl was an only child, and that she and her mother are dead.
Mm-hmm.
What about the father?
Before the murder, he had gone back to Russia, Annie. Mm-hmm. The Soviet government, with a war headed its way, kept him over there.
When he heard what had happened to his wife and daughter, Miss Williams, the poor fellow had to be put in a madhouse.
Gee. Well, you think he's been released and is back in this country?
It's possible.
After what's happened, I'd say it's probable.
Oh. Well, then all you have to do is to find him.
Miss Williams, how do you find a man you've never seen and who has no criminal record?
Now, the only thing I can remember, even being said about him, Logan, in a descriptive way, I mean, was that he was a big and a gentle guy.
I don't remember the gentle part, but his bigness clicked with me as soon as you mentioned the Ivanov case.
Did anybody see a big guy come into this camera shop before Jake was killed?
I don't know, but the last sale he made before he was killed was for stuff to be delivered to a Mr. P. Candido.
Candido?
Yeah, here's his order book with the name and address.
Hey. Hey, that's Pat Candido.
Pat?
Sure, Pat Candido. You know him, Logan. He used to be an on the news.
Yeah.
And if Pat happened to see that big guy,
it's been his business to notice things.
Come on, we're calling on Candido right away.
A medical examiner says that Jake was killed at about 7:30, Candido. You say you left his shop at about that time?
Yes, Jake said he was closing up his place and going home. But I saw someone go in right after I left.
What'd he look like, Pat?
He was big, Casey. That's all I can tell you about him.
Oh, well, you got to tell us more than that, fella. That guy was Jake's murderer, now think.
I've been thinking. He was just a big guy I saw looking in a window and never expected to see again.
And you were supposed to be a hot press photographer before you got soft and went into the baby picture racket. You were supposed to have a nose for news.
Oh, was my nose supposed to tell me he was going to commit a murder?
Oh, I'm sorry, Pat.
Well, I'm sorry I let you down, Casey, but I just don't remember. Wait a minute.
Hmm?
That big guy has eyes like a baby's.
Like a bit? What do you mean?
I take pictures of young kids all day, and, well, the babies, the infants, their eyes are different. They seldom focus when they look at you. They seem to look through you and all around you and not at you.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Pat, but that isn't much help. Is that the best you can do for us, huh?
That's all I can do for you.
Yeah, well, thanks, pal. It's at least more than we had before.
Well, now, that isn't enough to give Casey warning of a man who undoubtedly intends to strangle him next week. Now, what are you going to do about that, Captain Logan?
Don't worry, Miss Williams. Casey won't be alone any moment of the day or night from now on.
Huh? What do you mean I won't be alone?
Pal, I'm not particularly concerned about your skin. But I want to catch a murderer and your bait. Wherever you go and whatever you do, a cop will be right beside you.
You know, I feel like a 2-year-old kid that isn't allowed out without his nursemaid. It's bad enough in the daytime, but when I have to look at one of you cops in my own apartment at night here...
I don't like it any better than you do, Casey. If you were a pleasant company, it wouldn't be so bad, but you do nothing but gripe.
Well, I'm sorry, Mac. Would you like a drink?
I would, yeah. But if I touched the drop and the captain found it out, I'd be back to pavement pounding in a uniform. When he gives orders to guard a guy, he means you don't do it with liquor under your belt.
Nuts. There isn't even any sociability with you, Lugs.
Well, you ought to be glad we're on our toes. You know, Casey, it's just a week ago tonight since Jake Blumberg was knocked off. And you're next.
Mm. I could handle that strangler by myself. I'm not anemic, you know.
You don't know the guy, Casey.
Wonder if Ivanov has a Russian accent.
No, it isn't likely. He was brought to this country as a kid and lived here most of his life.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's almost midnight, Mac.
Yeah.
Start work tomorrow on the 8 a.m. shift, so I might as well hit the sack.
Yeah, I'll be able to do a little sleeping myself tonight. Hope my relief shows up at 12 sharp.
Who is your relief tonight?
Oh, some guy named Norris. I don't know him. He's a uniformed cop from the precinct house.
Uniformed cop?
Yeah, Detective Bureau has enough men to do all its work right now, Casey. We homicide guys especially have more than we can do.
I know that.
Of course, a plain clothes guy like me will pick you up in the morning.
That'll be something I'll look forward to.
Yeah.
Well, I hope Patrolman Norris won't mind a little fancy snoring. Well, I'm going to change into my pajamas.
All right, this is the place, Norris. Casey's apartment's 3B.
Thanks for giving me a lift here, Lieutenant.
Sorry, I was going this way. I remember your instructions, lad. No sleeping on this job. Keep your eyes open and your ears working. Anything happen to Casey while you're on duty, it'll be too bad for you. And if you're lucky enough to nab the strangler, you can store away that uniform and get yourself a detective shield.
I'll be on the job, sir.
All right, you find a drive-it-yourself elevator back of the lobby stairs. Good night, Norris.
Night, Lieutenant.
Good evening, officer.
Evening.
Going to Mr. Casey's apartment.
Who wants to know?
I'm a friend of his. Just left him. The detective with him said he was expecting his relief.
Oh, I see.
Here's the elevator. I just got out of it. Press number 3 button there.
Oh, thanks.
You went to sleep nice and quiet, officer. Hardly a sound. Now I'll take you to the roof and tie you up. You're big like me. Your uniform will fit me fine.
Yeah, that relief cop is over 5 minutes late already, Casey.
Well, you're actually off duty now, Mac. How about that nightcap?
No, no, thanks. Not till the guy gets here.
Here I'm all ready to hit the beauty rest, and you keep me up because I'll give you a little hospitality before you shove up. Well, there's your relief.
No,
now I'll get him.
Yep, keep away from that door, Casey.
What do you mean?
It just might be the bird I'm guarding you against.
Oh, nuts.
Who's there?
Officer Norris, 23rd Precinct.
Okay, just a minute.
You cop with a lisp.
One of our best dicks on the safe and loft squad, Stutters.
Yeah, I know him.
All right, come in, Norris.
Thanks. I'm your relief.
Yeah, and a late relief.
I'm sorry, it couldn't be helped.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, too. All right, give me that nightcap, Casey, and I'll get out of here.
Okay, Mac. How about you, Norris?
No, thank you.
I guess you know your orders.
Yeah.
You know, I never run into you before, Norris. My name's McAvoy.
Nice to know you.
I'm Casey.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks. Here's your poison, Mac.
Oh, thanks, Casey. Well, here's how.
How?
Well, I'm heading for home now. You lock the door when I go out, Norris, and take care of this lug, Casey.
I'll take care of him.
You'll find him a pain in the neck, but you'll have to stand for that. Sock him if he gripes too much and put him to sleep.
I may do that.
Go on, get out of here, Mac.
Yeah, I'm on the way, Casey. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Now, I'll lock the door.
I'm going to bed, Norris. There's a lot of magazines on that table for you to read if you want. Some books in that case and this bottle. Help yourself to all of them.
Thanks very much.
You got a long, dreary night ahead of you.
All night's long.
Well, I'd hate to have your job, sitting up guarding a guy that snores.
Maybe you won't snore tonight.
You're an optimist. Well, good night.
Good night.
Say...
Yes?
How did a guy like you ever decide to be a cop?
It was a means to an end.
What end? Excuse me, I'm getting kind of personal on such short acquaintance, but you seem such a gentle sort of fellow that I...
gentle.
Why do you look at me like that, Mr. Casey?
Just sizing you up.
How do you size me up?
Okay. You're okay. I think I'll have a nightcap.
I prescribe it.
Sure you won't join me?
No, thank you. Detective McAvoy should be out of the building now. Well, on his way home, don't you think?
Yeah.
I think so, too. And since we won't be disturbed...
No, you don't! My eyes! The whiskey!
Yeah, I've got a full glass right in them, Ivanov.
I've got my hands on you now. You'll die like the others who killed my daughter.
Hey, you can't move so quick.
But you're not going to strangle me.
I can see. Again, I have a gun.
You won't use it, though. How was that for size? Now try this on your whiskers.
Boy, if you'd ever really gotten those big mitts of yours around my neck.
Hello, headquarters. Give me Captain Logan, will you? He isn't in, huh? Well, when he comes in, tell him Casey called. And to send a wagon up to my joint for the strangler. Yeah, he's sleeping right now in my apartment, and I'm afraid I'll wake him up if I start to snore. Oh, wait a minute. Give Logan another message for me. Tell him my opinion of his idea about having me guarded is phooey.
But, Casey, how did you get wise to that Ivanov guy in the cop's uniform?
His eyes were like a baby's, Ethelbert. They didn't focus.
The eyes of mad people are often like that.
Yeah. And Ivanov is as crazy as they come, poor devil. He's going to spend the rest of his life in a nut house. Of course, those funny eyes Pat Candido noticed put me on guard, you see. I filled that whiskey glass just in case. I wasn't going to take any chances.
And Ivanov had the cop's revolver, Ethelbert, in case he couldn't take chances.
Right. How'd you find the cop whose uniform Ivanov had taken?
He was on the roof, tied up and gagged. Otherwise, he was okay.
Ivanov had been listening outside Casey's door. He'd heard the name of the cop that was to relieve McAvoy, and that McAvoy didn't know him personally, so he just put poor Norris to sleep and took his place.
Seems to me that for a crazy guy, he went about his strangling business in a pretty smart way.
Well, insane people often have a very sane side, pal.
And vice versa.
Why look at me?
I wasn't looking at you, Casey. I was looking at that pretzel bowl.
Oh. Well, don't just look at it.
Mm-mm. It's empty again. Fill it up.
Yeah. And Ethelbert.
I know. Two more glasses of water.
Yeah. And cold this time.
Photographer, starring Stotz Cotsworth as Casey, is brought to you each Thursday by the Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation and is directed by John Dietz. The original music is by Archie Blyer, and the program features Miss Jan Miner as Anne and John Gibson as Ethelbert. Herman Chittison is the Blue Note pianist. Thursday night on CBS is the biggest show in town, so stay tuned for exciting dramatizations on Reader's Digest Radio Edition, which follows immediately over most of these stations. Next week, part of the country goes on daylight saving time. If your area remains on standard time, tune in your favorite radio program, Crime Photographer, 1 hour earlier. This is Tony Marvin saying goodnight for the Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation of Lancaster, Ohio, with offices in all principal cities of the United States and Canada. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
And that's Casey, crime photographer from April 24th, 1947, with A Gentle Strangler, starring Stotts Cotsworth, that was sponsored by Anchor Hocking Glass. Now, I have a lot of glass in my house that has Anchor Hocking. I have glasses. I have bowls.
I remember when you found the glasses and you bought a whole set. Was it Bed Bath Beyond?
No. I found it in an antique shop. They were actually glasses, little juice glasses from way back in the 1940s. But I recently bought some bowls. You know, that are microwavable, and they're anchor hocking.
Yeah. I've seen it still around. They're still making them.
Yeah, they must have been
very successful.
Yeah, they did very well with Casey Crime Photographer. All right, so that's Casey Crime Photographer. Also in that cast, you heard John Gibson and Jan Miner. That was heard on CBS. But right now, it's part three of The Shepherd Matter, starring Bob Bailey, from April 18th, 1956. Here's yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
This is Miss Streeter at Dr. Shepherd's office.
Yes?
Dr. Shepherd gave me your hotel number. He said you were to come in for a head x-ray.
Let me talk to the doctor about that.
Well, he's out on house calls right now, Mr. Dollar. He'll be back late this afternoon. He seemed very concerned over
you. He ought to be. A friend of his banged me on the head with a gun this morning. That's why the x-ray.
Well, could you possibly come in and have it made? Doctor was most insistent.
All right, Miss Streeter, I'll be right over.
Tonight, and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Richard Porter, 480 Webster Boulevard, Providence, Rhode Island. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Shepherd matter. Expense account item 4, $1, cab fare from my hotel to Richard Porter's office. Porter was sympathetic.
You know, I feel very responsible for this, Mr. Dollar. I hired you to look into all this.
Oh, it'll go away, it'll go away. I've been hit on the head before. Hey, do you have anything to drink in here?
Oh, sure, sure. You never can tell when a snake will come up and bite you.
Yeah.
Yeah, here you are.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I suppose you came in to give me your expense sheet now that it's all settled.
Not exactly, Mr. Porter. It isn't settled for me.
Well, certainly you know I'll assume any medical expenses involved here. That
no, I'm not talking about that, Mr. Porter. Sit down. Now, look, there's something going on here, and we might as well have it out. You hired me to investigate a client who wanted to buy $80,000 worth of straight life insurance, right?
Yes.
Now, that client explained why he called for that insurance. Not to my satisfaction, but he explained it. He said a man named Paul Forbes had threatened his life. Threatened it because Dr. Shepherd had advised Forbes' wife to get a divorce.
I know you didn't believe this, but the facts now seem to bear it out.
I went over to see Forbes this morning to talk to him about his threats. I managed to get my name out, and Forbes attacked me, so I got this. Then Forbes ran out. Mrs. Forbes and a servant in the house gave me first aid. All the time they were doing it, they were apologizing for Forbes and his violence. Finally, Dr. Shepherd came in, called the police, and told them to pick up Forbes.
And the police will pick him up if they haven't already, and Dr. Shepherd will prefer charges...
And that won't be that, Mr. Porter. Not as far as I'm concerned. Dr. Shepherd's story is still leaky.
I'm sorry, but I think it has more credence than ever in view of what's happened. You told me yourself his wife and the servant admitted Forbes had threatened Dr. Shepherd's life.
Oh, I believe that part. But Shepherd lies so much you can get to believing him.
What lies, for heaven's sake?
Oh, for one thing, his reason for not calling the police right away. I mean about how delicate Mrs. Forbes' condition was. She looked pretty healthy to me this morning. Another thing, he described Forbes as a man with homicidal tendencies. Now, Dr. Shepherd's supposed to be an expert on behavior. And he thought that if I talked to Forbes, I might settle the matter peaceably. But Forbes attacked me as soon as I told him my name. I didn't get a chance to talk.
Well, Dr. Shepherd has no control
over... He felt pretty sure I could talk to Forbes. If you don't like that, let me go on. What reason did Forbes have to hit me? He didn't know me from a load of coal. Somebody put him up to it.
Who?
Who do you think?
Shepherd, for some reason?
Shepherd was the only one who knew I was going right over there.
But why?
I don't know.
What would he gain?
My business for an x-ray.
You're joking now.
I suppose I am, but I got a headache. I feel off.
Oh, here. How about Mrs. Forbes?
Oh.
Here.
Thanks. Oh, she seemed like a genuine enough person. Not sick the way I expected her to be. Someone slugged her recently. There was a bruise under one eye.
Shepard said her husband was an erratic, ruthless, violent man.
Well, look, I'm stubborn, Mr. Porter. I still think Shepard's been lying to me. If for no other reason than I think I know the breed.
Well, what's all this got to do with the insurance application?
Well, that's another thing I don't know. Expense account item 5, $3, care fare, to Dr. Shepard's one-story building to have my head x-rayed. Shepard was still out, but Miss Streeter did the honors, almost in silence. Outside of sit still and hold it, nothing much was said.
Well, the picture's okay, Mr. Dollar. I looked at it. I didn't see anything wrong. Of course, the doctor will call you when he's had a chance to see it.
Swell.
You must have got quite a blow. That's a nasty bruise you have.
Oh, it's pretty good, all right. He swung his gun hard.
Well, the doctor will be back about mid-afternoon. He can call you at your hotel?
Yes.
Well, thank you for coming in.
I want to ask you a question, Miss Streeter.
Yes?
Are you in love with him?
What?
Are you in love with Dr. Shepard?
Well, that's rather my own business, isn't it? Unless, of course, in your investigation of whatever you're investigating, for some reason I'm under your scrutiny.
Well, I suppose it is, and I suppose I can take that to say yes.
I've become rather angry with you, Mr. Dollar, but frankly, you seem rather ridiculous.
I suppose so. He's a liar, isn't he? I mean, Shepard. One more question. I told you on the phone a friend of Dr. Shepard's did this to my head. Now, did you ever ask me who that friend was? Well, I'd think you'd be curious about a thing like that, Miss Streeter.
I think I have a great deal of work to do, Mr. Dollar.
Expense account item 6, another $3, some more cab fare. This time back to my hotel where I picked up my rented car, filled it with gasoline, item 7, $5.30, and drove out to Pawtucket. At the home of Mrs. Clara Shepard, I explained my name and business to an elderly man who answered the door. He asked me to wait a moment, then returned and said Mrs. Shepard would see me. She was a bright-looking, gray-haired woman in her mid-60s, elegantly groomed and obviously well cared for. We went through the politenesses, then got down to business.
My son applied for $80,000 worth of life insurance and named me beneficiary.
That's about it.
I wonder what he's up to.
So do we.
You mean so do I. You don't trust anyone, do you, Mr. Dollar?
He said his life had been threatened. He told me he wanted to make certain you were well taken care of in case anything happened to him. He was lying, wasn't he?
I haven't seen him, talked to him. Even had a Christmas card from him in 3 years. Maybe he does worry about his poor old mother now and then. I'm flattered.
What you're saying about him isn't very flattering.
Oh, I don't think Charles ever thought much of me as a mother. Still doesn't, I'm sorry to admit. But then I don't think too much of him as a son. So there we are. Is it too early for a cocktail, Mr. Dollar?
How do you explain him already having a $20,000 policy on himself and wanting to kick it up to $100,000, you the beneficiary?
No explanation. That's why I suggested a cocktail. To my friends here, Charles is a successful doctor in Providence who calls me faithfully every day, sends me gifts, and is always assured that I am well and happy and occupied in my old age. I guess I like you, Mr. Dollar, perhaps because, with all your gruffness, you might be nice to your mother. No, Charles and I aren't close. Never have been. I can tell you this. I don't need his closeness, at least not in a financial way. If Charles were to die and I received $100,000, it would mean a rather difficult tax problem. If he were to die, part of me would die too. I'd like you to have just one martini with me. And then you may go, Mr. Dollar.
I had the one martini with the tall, stately woman who struggled against tears. It was an old struggle with her, increasingly difficult, I guess, as the years kept on. We talked no more of her son, or the insurance, or the threat on his life. I left there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I drove back over to Providence and got to Dr. Shepard's office about 5:45. A broad-shouldered man in a tweed suit was in the reception room. He got to his feet when I walked in.
Dr. Shepard?
No. Don't I know you?
Yeah, I was thinking the same. Wait a minute. Yeah, your name is Dollar, your insurance investigator.
Yeah, you're
Phil
so...
Crosby, yeah. Providence Police.
Well, I met you in New Hartford once. Oh, I didn't know you were down here.
Hey, you must be the one. As Dr. Shepard called downtown about a threat in his life and said an insurance investigator had been slugged trying to help him out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, where is he?
I don't know.
I rang that buzzer. There's no one around at all. What's this all about?
Well, a man named Paul Forbes threatened the doctor's life. He slugged me. You got a pickup out on him yet?
No, not yet. Trying to pin the doctor down all day long. Been out on house calls, emergencies, everything else. We have to get his signature on a complaint.
Oh, I thought that was all taken care of by now.
Well, hello.
Hello, Mr. Dollar.
Hello, Miss Streeter. This is Phil Crosby from the police department.
Police?
I'd like to see Dr. Shepard, miss.
Is anything the matter?
Just want to see him.
Oh, goodness, he was here 10 minutes ago. He sent me over to the pharmacy to pick up these things. Oh.
What?
We had an emergency. 1213 Putnam Street.
Got a note from him?
Yes.
May I see it, please? There's no name on this, Miss Streeter. You recognize the address at all?
No, I don't. Doctor wouldn't take a random emergency unless it were very unusual.
This might be unusual, Phil.
This is down by the water. How bad off do you think Forbes is?
Mad, had a gun, plenty rough. I rode down in the police car with Phil Crosby. I had a feeling about the acuteness of that emergency. As a matter of fact, I had a feeling about the acuteness of everything that had happened that day, from the time a half-crazed man had slugged me with a gun. The feeling was heavier than ever when we hit the neighborhood.
Come on.
All right.
Wait.
Oh, what?
1213 Putnam Street. That'd have to be that vacant lot over there. This is 1240 here. The rest belongs to the warehouse.
Yeah. Phil.
Huh?
That car empty on the plates.
Yeah. Now, that's Dr. Shepard's car.
Motor's still warm.
Must be around here somewhere looking for the address.
That's a dead end there.
I better call in for some help. Fog's coming in if he's wandering around here.
Yeah. Phil Crosby went off to find a telephone and request help. I stood by Dr. Shepard's car, waiting and listening and smoking. Nothing happened. No one cried out. No guns went off. Then Crosby drove up in the police car.
Come on, report's in.
A report was in, all right. We drove two blocks down the street where a small, curious crowd of people had already gathered in the cheerless fog. A uniformed man from the Harbor Division was standing over what appeared to be a bundle of clothes lying in a heap. We bent over it, and Phil looked up at me with a question mark.
That Shepard, Johnny?
Yeah, that's him.
Yep, I'd say he's been dead less than half an hour. Now, here's our star to tell you about tomorrow's intriguing episode of this week's story.
Tomorrow, a liar's still lying, even though he's dead. Join us, won't you, and I'll tell you all about it. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by John Dawson, it is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone. Be sure to join us tomorrow night, same time and station, for the next exciting episode of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
That's Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, from April 18, 1956, part three of this five-part adventure called The Shepherd Matter, starring Bob Bailey. Hope you enjoyed that. Let's take a quick break, then it's more on the WGN Radio Theater. Hey, Lisa, you know, Woodman's is my favorite place to shop for groceries because not only do they have
the biggest,
best selection, but you kind of ruined it for
me. Oh, okay. Start over. Say it again.
Right,
I won't say
go.
Anything
ready?
This time. Yeah.
Okay. I'm warming up here. Okay, here we go. Hey, Lisa, you know what?
What?
My favorite place to shop is Woodman's.
Why is Woodman's
well,
your favorite place to shop?
Well, because they have the biggest selection of food.
Right.
The lowest prices.
Right.
And? The biggest carts.
Ah, I didn't know you were going to say that.
I could put myself in that cart.
Then who would push you down the rows?
I don't know. I would pay somebody to do that probably.
I will do that job.
I could put all the food in the cart, sit in the cart, and then I could be pushed all around. But seriously, folks, if you want to save money when you shop for your groceries, go to Woodman's. And not only that, and you really will save money.
Oh, I know.
Not only that, but if you take a photo of your Woodman's receipt and email it to woodmanswgn@gmail.com.
Yep.
We will send you 12 classic radio shows via digital download.
What a deal.
Not bad. All right, in our next hour, it's Duffy's Tavern Plus Part 4 of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. So stick around. We'll be back after the news. Welcome back. Hour 4 of the WGN Radio Theater. In this hour, it's Duffy's Tavern from 1944. Ed Gardner stars along with his special guest, Carol Landis. And our fun fact this week, Lisa, is about Carol Landis. There's a beautiful picture of her at our Facebook page.
Right. It's on our Facebook page, and you can check it out there with some information about it. It's a beautiful photo.
Yeah. You will hear Carol Landis on Duffy's Tavern in this hour, along with part 4 of this 5-part adventure on yours truly, Johnny Dollar, called The Shepherd Matter. That is all coming your way after these words. Welcome back. Hour 4 of the WGN Radio Theater. We're here every Saturday night from 10 p.m. until 3 o'clock in the morning. 5 full hours each and every week. You'll hear all your favorite classic radio shows right here on the greatest radio station of all time, WGN AM 720. Duffy's Tavern is coming your way. But first, I want to remind you that we have a classic radio club. If you're not a member of the Classic Radio Club, you are missing out, because if you're a member of the Classic Radio Club, you'll get sent 10 classic radio shows right to your email each and every month, along with a PDF of liner notes that I write with fun facts, historical information about each of those 10 shows. Or you can get those same 10 shows on 5 CDs in a collector case, and that collector case has pictures of the radio stars that are in those 10 shows. It's a really nice presentation. Learn all about the Classic Radio Club by going to our website, classicradioclub.com. There are hundreds of your fellow listeners that are part of this club. It's growing all the time. Each week, people are signing up. Go to classicradioclub.com. For the first month, you can experience it for only $1, and you can cancel at any time. Go to classicradioclub.com. All right, you ready for Duffy's Tavern?
Oh, always, Carl.
You know, this was such a funny series. In fact, I'd have to say it's probably in the top 3 funniest radio series of all time. Came to radio way back in 1940. Duffy's Tavern was a flea-infested dive on 3rd and 23rd Streets in New York City, where the elite meet to eat. Ed Gardner played Archie, the metaphor mixing manager. Duffy was never seen nor heard on the series. He was an absentee owner who called in at the beginning of each show to check on things. Now, Duffy's man-hungry daughter, Miss Duffy, played by Shirley Booth, Florence Halep, and Sandra Gould, would be on hand to check on things for Duffy. Regular characters on Duffy's Tavern included Eddie the waiter and Clancy the cop. Often guest stars played a hand in Archie's misadventures and his get-rich-quick schemes. Writers included Abe Burrows, future MASH writer Larry Gelbart, and Dick Martin of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. In 1949, the entire show moved offshore to Puerto Rico for tax advantages. Very interesting. No other radio show that I know of did that. It's time now for Duffy's Tavern. His special guest is Carol Landis. From April 11th, 1944, here's Ed Gardner starring now in Duffy's Tavern.
You're invited to drop in where the elite meet to eat. Duffy's Tavern.
Hello, Duffy's Tavern, where the elite meet to eat. Archie, the manager, speaking. Duffy ain't here. Oh, hello, Duffy. Tonight, Carol Landis, the curvaceous cookie from Hollywood. Curvaceous. What's the difference what it means? It looks great. Ah, she's a beautiful dame, Duffy. Has she got what? Mm-hmm. Also, a very high forehead. What? Mrs. Duffy had a shape like that when you married her? Yeah, but since then, her figure's been a total loss. Huh? Well, naturally. Everything going out and nothing coming in. Huh? Offer her a job here. Duffy, it'd ruin us. Well, with calves like hers around, who's going to order pig's feet? I'll call you back, Duffy. So long.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Duffy's Tavern. Come in and meet Finnegan, Eddie the waiter, Miss Duffy, Joe Venuti and his orchestra, our special guest tonight, Carol Landis, and Archie himself, Ed Gardner.
Let's see now. Leave a spoon neath the moon, dear Miss Landis.
Say, Mr. Archie.
Wait a minute, Eddie. You're making me lose my muse.
In your case, no muse is good muse.
Oh, yeah? Well, listen to this poem that I'm writing in Carol Landis' behoof. Leave a spoon neath the moon, dear Miss Landis, while I whisper how dainty your hand is. Joe Cupid has got me over a barrel, but I'll wait for you till Christmas Carol. What do you think of it, Eddie? Huh?
What do you think I think of it?
That's a nasty thing to say. After all, I just dashed the thing off you. Could Shakespeare do better?
Even right now, he could. Well, I suppose poetry means you've fallen in love again.
Could be, Annie.
Boy, that love bug must use up all his red points on you.
Well, Eddie, you know, it's spring, and in the spring, the old saying is, a young man's thoughts turn to something a little fancy. It happens to every normal guy.
Yeah, but it happens to you all year.
Oh, can I help it if I'm normal more frequently than other guys? Yeah, Eddie, there's something in me makeup that gives me a yen for beautiful dames.
Now all you need is some makeup to give them beautiful dames a yen for you.
What do you mean, Eddie?
Well, now look, I mean every girl you meet. Take Michelle Morgan. She threw you over. Gertrude Lawrence walked out on you. Ida Lupino gave you the air. Veronica Lake gave you the air.
Eddie, are you trying to imply that I am fickle?
Not fickle. Futile.
Leave us not split infinitives, Eddie. You just watch me tonight when Carol Landis comes down here.
Hello, Archie.
Oh, well, Miss Duffy, I ain't seen hide and seek of you in weeks. Where have you been?
Home, having a battle with a horrible flu germ.
Oh, how is your mother?
Please, Archie, I'm talking about a very contagious germ.
Oh, I beg your pardon. How's your father?
Oh, he's fine, thank you.
Well, that's good. Well, I'll see you later, Miss Duffy. I'm very busy now.
You want to hear how I got the flu?
No.
Well, last week my girlfriend, Vera Fogarty, got us a double date with two sailors.
Vera Fogarty got you a date with two sailors? She's picking up sailors again, huh?
She did not pick them up.
She didn't, huh?
No.
Then how did she meet them?
She happened to be swimming past the battleship. Anyways, us and the sails went out for a drive together, the four of us. And did we have a miserable time?
You did, huh? What happened?
Well, the first thing was, they crowded me and my sailor in the back seat.
Well, two in the back seat, that ain't crowded.
Have you ever been in the back seat with a sailor?
Well, not personally.
Besides, this was a motorcycle.
A motorcycle? Now, wait a minute. If this is a motorcycle and you was in the back... Where did Vera sit?
On the handlebars, naturally. That is, until the accident.
Until what accident?
When we stopped for a red light and Vera didn't.
No, like Vera. That's very droll. So, leave me make a dull story short. You kissed the sailor goodnight and you caught the flu from him, huh?
That is not a very nice thing to say, Archie. You know very well I'm too much of a lady to kiss a man the first time I meet him, if he has the flu. Say, maybe he did have the flu. How else could I have got it?
Well, anyways, Miss Duffy, don't think it's nice to have you back again. But... But do me a favor. Will you keep away from guys? You know, with you, it's like a drug, like a dope.
What?
Oh, hello, Finnegan.
Well, Miss Duffy, how you feeling?
Better, thank you.
I was deeply concerned about your ill. You know, that flu can turn into a nasty cold. Did you get the box of cough drops I sent you?
Yes, thank you. That was very thoughtful of you, Finnegan.
Well, I always try to be thoughtful. Too bad you got better. You should have seen the wreath I had picked out.
Well, that's the breaks, Finnegan.
Anyway, Miss Duffy, glad to see you back.
Thank you.
Is Carol Landis really coming here tonight?
Why, certainly, Finnegan.
Arch, could you lend me the loan of the quarter?
Wait a minute. What do you want a quarter for?
In case I have to take her out.
Finnegan, you kill me. You want me to lend you the loan of a quarter to take Carol Landis out?
Don't worry, Arch. I ain't gonna spend it. I just want to flash it.
Finnegan, flash it. A dame like Carol Landis ain't impressed by a quarter. A quarter wouldn't even tip her coiffure.
Coiffure?
Yeah.
So who's that, the guy that drives a car?
No, Finnegan, a coiffer is a male hair washer. It's what the French call a shampoos. quarter to take out a movie star.
Oh, what's the matter? To me, Carol Landis is just another...
Finnegan, please, when you mention Carol Landis' name in public, smile. Don't forget, sir, that someday that name might be my name.
You mean that you and Carol Landis are...
Yes, I do.
Arch, when did it happen?
As soon as I meet her. Watch me work, Finnegan.
Say, Archie.
Toby?
I hear Carol Landis is coming down here to talk about women taking jobs.
Yeah, she is, but believe me, Toby, if me plans matriculate, she ain't gonna be interested in that stuff. I am proud to say that my wife will not have to take no job.
Well, why not?
She's got money of her own. You may play, Mr. Venuti. Venuti's band. Oh. Well, look, what do you think of Venuti himself? Uh-huh, too, huh? Well, look, Duffy, you're too critical. After all, this band could be worse. How? Well, there could be more of them. Well, they should what? They should be seen and not heard? Duffy, you're nuts. They look even worse than they sound. Well, look, I'll have a talk with Venuti. Huh? Tell him what? Okay.
Hey, Arch, what was that?
That was a request.
What was the request?
Never mind, you couldn't do it anyway. To be frank, Mr. Venuti, me and Duffy both feel that your band leaves something to be desired.
Namely?
Namely, music.
What are you talking about, Arch? These guys are very good musicians. Over half of them can read music.
Look, Mr. Venuti, I don't pretend to be no Tachkalanis. But I don't even say that I know much about music. All I know is what me ears tell me. And me ears tell me that you don't know much about music neither. Now, will you and your lease breakers play a number? And remember, a little pizzicato goes a long, long way.
Okay, Arch, come on, fellas, let's go. And remember, no crap games during the rest. One, two...
What do you think? You think there's any improvement in Venuti's band?
I don't know. It seems such a waste to make all that noise and not turn out a single boiler.
Well, at least they're trying. Hey, wait a minute, Eddie. Here comes Carol Landis. What a dish, huh? Oh, boy. And look at her. What a lady. What a lady. Look how she passes the cuspidor and ignores it. Now, there's a real lady for you, Eddie. Well, Carol Landis. Carol, just stand there in all your glorious punkitude. What a beauty.
What a beast.
Please, don't say a word. Just stand there and leave me drink to me only with thine eyes. Never before has such radiant lassitude ever desecrated our portholes.
Say, whatever happened to the King's English?
I know he is. that's a joke, by the way. Look, Carol, won't you, pray have a seat?
If someone will pray, wipe off that chair.
Well, it's a trifle dusty, but it's easy to clean. Just sit down and wiggle a little. That's right, that's it. Yeah. You ought to see Mrs. Duffy do that. She cleaned 6 chairs at once. Yeah, but enough of this dish in the dirt here. Oh, Miss Landis, this is Miss Duffy, the daughter of the establishment.
Good evening.
Likewise, I'm sure. Gee, Miss Landis, you know, you look exactly the same in the person as you do in the flesh.
Well, thank you.
You and I are lucky to have such gorgeous figures.
Knock wood.
And our hair is both blondes, too.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Yes. What was yours before?
Green with red sideburns.
Oh, then it's good you changed it.
Now, please, get back to the cash register. And, Carol, leave us. Get back to the eternal triangle. You and me.
Look, Archie, I came here to talk about a very serious problem.
What, that stuff that Toby was saying about women taking jobs?
What do you mean, that stuff?
Carol, dames like you ain't made for Chris work. You are a frail gossamer who should be placed on a pedestrian. You're different. You should be worshipped, cherished, nursed.
I know. Woman's place is in the home.
That's right. It's the first law of nature. Tomatoes should cling to the vine. But, Carol, look how happy you'd be. Think of another world. Think of you and me in our own little home with a couple of ivy-covered kids.
Look, Archie, leave us, face it. I ain't in love.
Carol, why do you repulse me?
Just to make it mutual.
Well, you're wrong. A girl like you needs a guy like I. A guy who can protect you, as a man should, with his muscles.
What muscles?
Look, Carol, I'm not the kind of a guy who wears his muscle on his sleeve. Mine is inner spring muscles. Yes, sir. Like steel, as many a guy who has learned who has punched me in the nose.
Archie, I'm supposed to deliver a message to the women, and I'm going to deliver it.
Oh, you and them jobs for dames. I'd like to see a dame in a job like mine. I'd like to see you running my job.
I could do anything you could do.
Anything I could do, huh? Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it. What is it, Eddie?
Mr. Moriarty just tore his pants on a nail, and he wants you to lend him a pair of yours.
Touché, Carol? Second, Carol. Hello? Hello, Duffy. You want to talk to Carol? Okay, Miss Landis, the bunny face would like to talk to you.
Hello? Oh, hello, Mr. Duffy. We met where? I smiled to you from the where? Mr. Duffy, I have never been on a runway. What? Oh, you like the speech anyway. Oh, how would I like a job here? No, I don't think I'd... Wait a minute. What sort of a job? General manager? Over Archie?
Hey, wait a minute. What goes on here?
Please. Exactly what would my duties be, Mr. Duffy? Yes. 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 And what? Mr. Duffy.
Miss Landis, did I hear right? Did I understand that Duffy has made you the general manager? My boss?
You heard right.
Oh, wait a minute. I got to think this thing over. Hey, Venuti. Hey, Joe. Leave us have a number.
Just a second. That's my job. Hey, Venuti. Hey, Joe. Leave us have a number.
Oh. dirty trick. Putting a dame in here is my boss.
What's the matter, Mr. Archie?
I'm going nuts. Carol Anders is going to be me boss, me manager. Order me around. Make a slave out of me.
Congratulations. Is she really going to marry you?
Ed, this is no time for levity. That dirty Duffy, putting a dame in charge. Hey, wait a minute. I got an idea. Maybe this is a boomerang in sheep's clothing.
What do you mean?
Eddie, I got a hunch this job is going to change Miss Landis's ideas about her work and about me.
Come on, Archie, get busy.
What do you mean?
Well, this place looks awful. It's filthy.
That discovery will not make you no Lady Columbus.
Hey, how long has it been since this joint had a thorough cleaning?
I don't know exactly, but you can gauge it by the amount of dust. It figures about a half an inch a month.
Well, don't you have a vacuum cleaner?
Well, we had one, but it got filled up, so we had to throw it away. Anything else, Your Majesty?
Yes. Where do you keep the napkins?
The napkins? We cut the napkins out for the duration 10 years ago.
I get it. You're going to try to make it tough for me, huh?
Oh, perish forbid. No, we're all going to cooperate. If Duffy wants to have ladies' help, he can have all ladies' help. Oh, Miss Venuti, Josephine.
Yes, Archibald, darling.
Josie, would you have the sweater girls play a number for Miss Landis?
Archibald, you are very inconsiderate. These girls have been standing over a hot trumpet all day.
Well, I don't know, Josephine. Phil Spitali's girls never seem to get tired. Maybe we should get a male band leader, too.
Look, dearie, don't threaten me.
Hi, Arch.
Oh, Miss Finnegan. Miss Finnegan.
Huh?
You look delightful. Is that a new frock?
Hi, Arch.
Finnegan. Wait a minute. Come here. You don't understand. This is Ladies' Day in Duffy's Tavern.
The Ladies' Day? Oh. Though, Archie, that is a Davoon apron you are wearing.
It's just a little thing I picked up in Paris. A schlepperelli. Oh, by the way, Finney, I love your hairdo.
Do you do? Do you like this off-the-scalp arrangement?
I'm crazy about it. I love it. Wherever did you get the idea?
Oh, in Madame Lefty's pool room.
Oh, cute.
Oh, girls, tea is set.
Oh, thank you, Edwina.
Oh, girls, look how graceful I'm drinking me tea with me pinky finger sticking out.
But, Miss Finnegan, you should take your other four fingers out of the tea.
Girls, I have great news. I just found a store downtown where you can buy, guess what?
What?
Girdles.
With real elastic?
With real elastic.
Oh, great. Then let's go buy some. We can make slingshots.
Oh, Finny, you slay me. I just adore your wit.
I'm really glad I came down here tonight.
So am I, Carol. You know something?
What?
You made me kind of proud of the fact that my mother was a dame. Duffy's, where the elite meet Dita. Archie the manager speaking. Hello, Duffy. Yeah, that's right. Next week, Charles Lawton. Yeah, if you come down here next week, you can meet him face to face, which will be a horrible double feature. Good night, Duffy.
Before we leave Duffy's, leave us put a couple of nickels in Duffy's jukebox. The plant is spinning. The needle comes down. It's music.
And that's Duffy's Tavern from April 11th, 1944. Special guest Carol Landis, Ed Gardner's stars. And you heard Helen Lynn as Miss Duffy for the first time in the series. Peter Van Steeden and his orchestra there, Eddie Green and Charlie Cantor. That was heard on the Blue Network. Hope you enjoyed that. All right, something I know you're going to enjoy. It's part four now of this five-part story, The Shepherd Matter, starring Bob Bailey on yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
Bill Crosby, Dollar. Were you in bed?
No. Nope.
Good. Put on your coat and come on downtown.
Can't it wait till morning?
Nope. Want me to send somebody out to pick you up?
Are you talking about an arrest?
I might be, Dollar. Whatever I have to do to keep you around.
I'll make it under my own steam, pal.
15 minutes. Room 203, City Hall, okay?
I may take 16 minutes if I feel like it.
And maybe you'll need longer. I want a real good story about Paul Forbes. A better one than you've told so far.
Tonight, and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Richard Porter, 480 Webster Boulevard, Providence, Rhode Island. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Shepherd matter. Swindle sheet item 7, 10 cents, one newspaper. It carried the story of Dr. Shepherd's murder and told how his life had been threatened by Paul Forbes earlier in the week. Obviously, Dr. Charles Shepherd had been lured to his death by Forbes, who had telephoned him, pretended to need a physician, waited until the victim appeared, and then shot him down. The police had an APB out for Paul Forbes. All parties concerned were notified. The deceased was survived by his mother, Mrs. Clara Shepherd of Pawtucket. Amen.
Come right in, Dollar. Sit down.
There were about 6 people in Crosby's office, among them Richard Porter, who had hired me to investigate Shepherd because of a suspicious insurance application. A uniformed officer from the Harbor Patrol who had discovered Shepherd's body, and 2 other men from Crosby's staff. I told them how I had been hired, that I didn't believe all of Shepherd's story about the threat on his life. I told them about Forbes slugging me for no apparent reason. I also mentioned the insurance matter had never been satisfactorily explained.
Well, it's never going to be explained as far as I can see, Dollar.
Oh, I'll find an explanation, Phil. You solve your murder and I'll do what I have
to do. We've got it solved. All we have to do is pick up Forbes, you know that.
I don't know anything. You get huffy with me on the phone and you start talking about arrest and I don't know anything.
You said that when you went to see Shepherd yesterday morning, he waved a gun at you, a .32.
That's right.
It wasn't on his body. He knew Forbes hadn't been picked up. His life was in as much danger as ever. Why didn't he carry the gun?
You know, that's a pretty good question, Phil.
Yeah.
What else?
He allegedly went out on an emergency call tonight. No little black bag in his car. No little black bag by his body. What doctor goes out on any call without his bag?
Oh, I wouldn't let that worry me so much. I'd find out if it was an emergency, or he knew who was going to meet him when he went out.
I thought you might have some ideas.
Have you talked to Mrs. Forbes?
Of course I've talked to her. She hasn't any idea where her husband might be hiding. She's sure he killed Dr. Shepherd. That servant in the house is sure. He told me about Shepherd being threatened by Forbes. Shepherd told you about being threatened. Forbes slugged you, slugged Mrs. Forbes. Been running around town like a madman all day. But everything you say and every way you say it, it comes out Shepherd was lying.
I did it on purpose. I wanted to worry you to death.
Yeah. Well, every officer in this town has Forbes' description and the license of his car. We ought to get him before the night's out. He's the boy.
Good luck, Phil. He was a good policeman with a lot of doubts. And he was mad about them. And that's what it generally takes to get matters straightened out. I found Kareen Streeter at the morgue, standing beside the marble slab on which a late employer had been laid. She looked pale and wan in her stiff white uniform and blue nurse's cape. Her eyes were red with tears, but no sound escaped her. Then she looked up at me once, sighed, and started out of the place. Wait.
Oh, no.
Well, I'd like to help you. I...
Can you help him? No. No, you can't. No one can.
I tried.
Who did it?
Well, the police say Paul Forbes shot him. It looks that way from all they can gather.
Over Mrs. Forbes?
Yes.
Oh. They're looking for him, I suppose.
Yes.
Well, you're something of a policeman, Mr. Dollar. Why aren't you out helping them or something?
Please, Miss Streeter, I know we've had words.
I'll answer that question you asked me earlier today.
What?
You asked me if I loved Dr. Shepherd. Yes, Mr. Dollar, I loved him. I loved him more than my whole life.
When she said that, and for some reason I don't know, I had a feeling that I was hearing the first bit of unembroidered truth I'd heard in 2 days. It didn't make me feel any better, but it did clear up something that had been in the back of my mind working its way to the front. Expense account, item 8, $6.70. A steak, 3 martinis, and an order of sliced tomatoes. I finished eating at 2:30 in the morning. I really didn't want it, but I did want to sit down and do some thinking. After that, I climbed into my rented car and drove out to Dr. Shepherd's office building. Expense account, item 9, $5 even. Bribe for watchman.
I shouldn't be doing this, you know. Might lose my job over it. But since you're from the insurance company, I guess you're all right.
I sure appreciate it.
Too bad about Dr. Shepherd. Nice fella.
Yeah, very nice.
What is it you think you'll find? Police been here till almost an hour ago, poking around.
Do you know if they found anything?
Oh, sure. Doctor's emergency kit. Heard him say he didn't take it with him when he went out in that last emergency.
Uh-huh. Well, I won't be long.
Oh, I'm going to come right in and watch you.
Shepherd had been a thorough man, and from all evidence, he and Miss Streeter kept and operated an efficient file system in the office. However, he had kept no medical history of his prime patient, Pauline Forbes. As a matter of fact, in checking over both the patient's files and the card files, there was no evidence to indicate that Mrs. Forbes had ever been a patient of Shepherd's, which seemed strange in view of the fact that he told me he treated her for 14 months or better and ended the treatment by advising her to divorce her husband. What's more, he had never mentioned that Paul Forbes had been one of his patients, but an entry dated some 2 years before disclosed the fact that Dr. Shepherd had examined, treated, and discharged Paul Forbes as a patient. These two developments supplied me with all of the curiosity I'd need for a while. Nurse Corinne Streeter's home address was duly noted on Dr. Shepherd's phone book. Oakdale House, surprisingly enough, on Oakdale Street. Special rates for nurses. Room 205.
Yes? Oh, Mr. Dollar.
How do you feel?
Not too good, Mr. Dollar. I only got home about 15 minutes ago. They kept me down there pretty long. Then Dr. Shepherd's mother came. Do you want to come in?
Yes, thanks.
It isn't much of a place, is it? I mean, I haven't straight...
Things like tonight aren't easy, I know, but... Look, Miss Streeter, I wish you'd help me and tell me who Dr. Shepherd was intending to marry.
Marry? Oh, I had no idea.
I was in the office a half an hour ago. He'd already made arrangements for a honeymoon, reservations on the Ile de France for next June. Any ideas?
Please go.
I can't. Look, I'm not here to hurt you. I'm here to help. I mean... Was it Mrs. Forbes?
What?
Look, Miss Streeter, things are all wrong about your doctor's death, about what happened before it. It'll all come out sooner or later.
Oh, I suppose it will. It's awful to say this, Mr. Dollar, but Mrs. Forbes was the only person doctors saw socially this last year. And she, of course, is married.
How'd they meet? When her husband was Dr. Shepherd's patient?
Yes, that's right. They became quite friendly.
Mrs. Forbes was never a patient, but Mr. Forbes was. Now, what can you tell me about Mr. Forbes?
Well, he came to see Dr. Shepherd a year or two ago and stopped coming in. I believe he requested a copy of his medical history to be sent to another doctor in Baltimore, I think it was.
Uh-huh. But Dr. Shepherd kept right on seeing Mrs. Forbes.
Yes.
Huh? All right. Do you have any idea why I was called in by the insurance broker?
At first, I didn't. But I don't understand what you're trying to do. The police want Mr. Forbes. What does it all mean?
It'll sicken you, Miss Streeter.
Well, tell me if you know. Tell me, please.
It means the wrong man was killed tonight. I was pretty sure of what I meant when I said that. And I was also pretty sure that Phil Crosby and the police department had recognized the setup. It so happened I had a head start in the way of information. And though it was 6 o'clock in the morning by that time, I decided to use it.
Mr. Dollar.
Hello, Mrs. Forbes. I'd like to come in.
What is it?
I should have tumbled to it right away, but your husband fit the part too well.
Look here. I've been through quite enough today with the police and all out looking for Paul and Dr. Shepherd being killed.
Stop looking pained and tired. I'm the guy that's tired. I'm the one who was going to be the star witness when the state tried Shepherd for killing your husband.
What?
Why not get a star witness for free? Why not make a suspicious insurance move so an investigator would be called in? An investigator who'd back up a self-defense plea for your doctor and get him off on justifiable homicide.
Get out of here! Get out of here, or I'll call the police!
And you and the doctor sail to France in June and live happily ever after? What's the matter? Wouldn't your husband give you a divorce?
Go ahead.
If you say it's that way, Mr. Dollar, and you know everything, then it must have been that way.
Only it got fouled up. Your husband did shoot your boyfriend after all, just as he threatened to.
Get out of here! You can't prove any of it, not one word of it!
Oh, you're right about that, Mrs. Forbes. I can't prove anything, not a thing. Shepard's dead, and they want your husband for it. He threatened Shepard, and they'll get him for it, and that's that. But you have something to live with for the rest of your life. Your doctor's gone, he'll never come back. Or maybe you can just have a cup of coffee and forget all about it.
Get out! Get out! Leave me alone! Leave me alone!
What?
Yeah, that's it, Phil. That's what was supposed to happen. Shepard had it planted all over town how Forbes had threatened his life. He had witnesses. He had me, even. All he had to do was go out and shoot Forbes any place, any time. But Forbes got him first. Can people get by with this kind of thing in our courts of law? If and when you get your hands on Paul Forbes, will he have any kind of defense?
Oh, he'll get him, Dollar. The other I can't answer. What you just told me can't be proven. I don't see how a lawyer can do much for a guy who threatens another man's life and then finally guns him down, do you?
But it was Forbes who was the marked man all this time. He was supposed to die. If it could be proved that Forbes was a patsy, that the doctor intended to gun him down...
Up to the judge and jury, Johnny. When we get Forbes, he'll be arraigned and indicted for first-degree murder. Don't worry about that part. The rest is up to the court, out of our hands. After all, we're pretty sure Forbes shot and killed Dr. Shepard.
Hang up that phone, Dollar.
You still on the wire, Johnny?
Hang it up or I'll blow your head off.
Paul Forbes looked the part of a fugitive. His coat was ripped in several places. The knuckles on his left hand were torn and raw. There was mud on his shoes and pant legs. His eyes told the rest of the story. He was blazing mad. He had a gun. And he wasn't afraid to use it.
Now, here's our star to tell you about tomorrow's intriguing episode of this week's story.
Tomorrow I find out how hard it is to kill a lie. Sometimes you have to kill it twice. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by John Dawson, it is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone. Be sure to join us tomorrow night, same time and station, for the next exciting episode of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
That's Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, part four of The Shepherd Matter, starring Bob Bailey, from April 19th, 1956. Let's take a quick break, then it's more on the WGN Radio Theater.
I wanted to remind our listeners about Vistro, because what a great time it is to know about Vistro. I know we've been talking about it for a while, but what a perfect time it is to have a meal delivery service as opposed to going into the grocery stores right now.
Yeah, I think they've saved my life, Vistro. I eat Vistro every single day.
And that's a big feat, too, because you've never tried vegetarian food prior to Vistro.
Food, no, and it's delicious.
So in case you haven't heard, Vistro is an all-organic vegan subscription service. They deliver a wide variety of plant-based meals straight to your home. The meals are convenient. They are easy to make. They are healthy.
Listen,
and they
if
are
I can make them,
super
Lisa,
delicious.
Can you imagine if I can make them?
Well, how do you make them?
Well, mostly just put them in the microwave.
That's it.
But you could sometimes put them in the oven too. There's two. They give you two choices, really.
Right.
Yeah.
So they
really
go
easy.
Right from the freezer into the microwave or
and then
the
into
oven,
my tummy.
And that's that. I don't see how you can do better, especially right now. But I started using Vistro well before all of this started. I know you were a recent convert and you love the country fried chicken, which of course isn't actually chicken.
I had meatloaf. It was lentil meatloaf the
other day. Isn't that something? There's a
delicious. It tasted like meatloaf, but it was made on a lentil.
I mean, it's so healthy. There's a vegetarian lasagna, which is delicious. And I know my favorite oatmeal breakfast pie.
Oh, the breakfast oatmeal.
And I know you had shown me a picture of your Tuscan calzone.
Yeah. I'm telling you, folks, you should check out Vistro. Check out their website at Vistro, V-E-E-S-T-R-O.com.
You'll love Vistro. Carl and I love it. We hope that you will, too.
All right. In our next hour, it's Whitehall 1212, true crime case from London. Although it was a fully American production, it was made to sound like it was coming from, across the pond, as they say. And then we'll have part five of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, that's coming your way after the news. Hour five of the WGN Radio Theater. We're here every single Saturday night from 10 p.m. until 3 o'clock in the morning, bringing you all your favorite classic radio shows. In this hour, it's Whitehall 1212, which is a true crime series that was broadcast from America, but made to sound like it was coming from London. Very interesting series coming your way in just a few minutes, along with part five, the conclusion of the Shepherd Matter, starring Bob Bailey on Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. All coming your way after these words. Welcome back. Hour five of the WGN Radio Theater. You know, Lisa, we have had a lot of people lately joining the Classic Radio Club. I guess people are tired of just watching TV. They want to hear more classic radio shows. It's a great time to join the Classic Radio Club. You will get 10 shows sent to you each and every month via digital download or on 5 CDs. I know you get the digital downloads.
I do. I get the same 10 shows every month, and I get the same quality shows that you get on the CD, and I get all the historical liner notes that you write along with them, only I have the opportunity to store them on my iPhone or my MacBook.
I have a shelf, and I know Mike Costella does the same thing. I have a shelf in my living room, and every month I take that 5-CD set in the collector case with all the pictures of all the stars on there and everything. Right. I put it right there on the shelf.
Your shelf must be very large.
It's starting to get big, yeah. You can join for only $1 the first month. Check it out. Experience it. Go to our website, classicradioclub.com, classicradioclub.com. All right, it is time for Whitehall 1212. This was a true crime series that came to NBC Radio in 1951. Now, these crime cases were from the files of Scotland Yard's Black Museum, and they were dramatized with an all-British cast. Now, although this was an entirely American production, it billed itself as a completely British undertaking. Very interesting. It was created by Willis Cooper. He was the guy that brought us Lights Out and Quiet Please, so very famous producer. Whitehall 1212 was the exchange and telephone number of the Metropolitan Police Headquarters, or more simply, Scotland Yard. The series was hosted by Chief Superintendent John Davidson and Superintendent John Watkins. They were the curators of the Black Museum. We have a true crime case for you now called The Murder of Little Philip Avery from January 27, 1952. Here is Whitehall 1212.
Whitehall 1212.
This is Scotland Yard.
For the first time in history, Scotland Yard opens its secret files to bring you the true, authentic stories of some of its most baffling cases.
These are the true stories, the unvarnished facts, just as they occurred, reenacted for you by an all-British cast. Only the names of the participants have, for obvious reasons, been changed. The stories are presented with the full cooperation of Scotland Yard.
Research on Whitehall 1212 is prepared by Percy Hoskins, chief crime reporter of the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper. Here are the participants in case number 693 MR966. Lance Corporal John Latimer of the Royal Corps of Signals.
It was my lorry, right enough.
Signaller Lewis Ruling of the same company.
It only hadn't rained that night.
Mrs. Elsie Avery, who lost her son.
He was a lively lad, but he never done any harm.
Miss Hartley, the colonel's daughter.
I was raised in the army, and I know what I see.
Superintendent Robert Lester of Scotland Yard.
If you will come into the Black Museum here with me, I think Chief Superintendent John Davidson can show you what we started with on this case. There's quite a collection in here of items that have figured in various cases we've worked on here in Scotland Yard. Some of them successfully, and some of them unsolved to date, shall we say. Come with me, please.
Ah, here you are, John.
This is Chief Superintendent John Davidson, who has a long and distinguished record with us.
Well, how do you do? Say, I finally found those things, Bob.
Ah.
I mislaid them, I'm afraid. Now, don't be afraid to look. They're not at all gruesome. Some folks seem to think we have a kind of chamber of horrors here. But I assure you, these things are quite innocuous for the most part. Now, this is the handkerchief.
Still quite clean, isn't it?
Wasn't always so clean, Bob. See, an ordinary khaki-colored handkerchief, such as millions of soldiers carried during the war.
I carried one.
And this, you don't recognize it? It's a gas mask cover. See the shoulder strap here? Oh, no, soldiers didn't carry this kind. This is red leather, or imitation leather, if you will. It was the type children carried with them. A child did carry this one. You can still see his name inside it here, written in his own kid's handwriting. Philip Ainsley Avery.
Philip Avery is dead.
But this little red leather bag helped Superintendent Lester start a man on the early morning stroll that ends on the gallows trap.
I was fortunate enough to be called by the Bucks Constabulary at once on this case. Too many times, Scotland Yard is called in only after the local police have exhausted their every resource. But those chaps in Buckinghamshire wanted help at once and badly in this little village in early November 1941. Station Superintendent... I'll not tell you his name. Brief me. He tossed the gas mask case, the one you just saw, on the desk.
This is all we've found so far.
Rather a bright-colored gas mask case for a boy to carry. How old is he?
I don't know whether we should say is or was, Superintendent.
Been looking for him how long now?
3.5 days now.
And this is all you found?
Aye. I'm scared if he's lost and if he'd throw away his respirator case.
Where'd you find it?
About a mile from here, down the road in the ditch.
Well-traveled road?
Not very.
Get anything from his parents?
Father's dead, and mother's well as you'd expect. He was the only child.
What did she think?
Well, first she thought he'd run away. He was quite dotty over the army, and she thought he'd be hanging around some camp or other in the vicinity.
He wasn't.
Well, they've all moved out last one a week ago. Oh, except for that convoy that went through here the day after the kid disappeared.
Could they have taken him along, a mascot perhaps?
Checked him first bloody thing.
Not with them.
No. Their OC telephoned me from somewhere over the East Coast. Nice chap, and worried. Said he'd turned out the whole party and no one had heard of the kid.
Good man. And the countryside is turned out, you said?
Not an able-bodied man in the village that isn't out in the country searching.
They'll find him, perhaps.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Yes.
Well, where do you want to start?
Who saw the boy last?
His mother. He's just setting off for school.
What about her?
Well, frankly...
Oh.
I've seen mothers who treated their kids better.
I'd better see her, hadn't I?
Killing her kid's awfully nasty, Superintendent.
Yeah.
She's my sister-in-law.
Oh.
Her brother's wife.
I thought the kid's name was Avery.
She married Avery after my brother was killed at Calais.
Where is Avery?
Killed at Tobruk.
She must be pretty bitter.
Bitter?
I'll have a talk with her.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. I was rather fond of my young nephew. Probably why I telephoned you so quickly.
Yeah. Thought you said every man in the village was out looking for the boy.
They are.
Who are all those chaps, then, coming down the road?
Where? They're carrying something.
Steady, steady, old boy.
It's my sister-in-law. That's it. They've found him.
In my time, I've seen a good many murdered persons. I shall probably see a good many more before I turn in my warrant card. But this one, an 11-year-old schoolboy. I can still see that great blue bruise on his forehead and his throat. I've got kids myself. His mother, she was quite controlled when I talked with her.
You'd better take me in, Superintendent. I did it.
How did you do it, Mrs. Avery?
It was such a lively boy, but he never meant any harm.
Everyone says he was a fine boy, Mrs. Avery.
I called him a little hellion. He was always talking about the army and how he was going to join up the minute he came of age. I hate the army.
Yes.
It's taken Philip's father from me and Avery. I couldn't bear the thought of losing him to it. I raised my hand to my son. He said it was his duty. I thrashed him so many times, but he was stubborn. Duty, I said. What about your duty to your mother? He was all ready for school, with his little gas mask case, standing in the door. Somebody, he said, somebody's got to take Daddy's place. Just like a kid talks. Daddy's place. And Mr. Avery's. And I slapped his face. I could cut off my hand. And he gave me such a look. And went away, and I never saw him again until I sent him to his death. I murdered him. The army got him, too.
I went away from that stricken woman. What else could I do? She was obviously convinced that she was responsible for the boy's death. But if her story was true, then that was a matter for her own conscience. If it was not, well, if she had killed the boy, there was time enough. The divisional superintendent drove me to the place where the body had been found in his own car. It was a side road off the main highway. Little traveled, and the local constable pointed out the place.
I was right there, sir. I marked it with a stick. I was with a searching party. We came across the road here, and Sammy Roberts, he seen that red gas mask bag lying on the edge of the ditch right over there. We picked it up, and we was looking around like, and I spotted the body lying right down there. Lying on his back, he was. Like he was asleep with his little arms folded on his chest. I thought he was asleep till I saw the blood. Though there weren't much of it for the rain, we run over here, and then we saw the mark on his forehead. It was dead all right, and quite peaceful, as I said. That's all, sir.
Been no other cars along here since you found him, then?
Only one or two, sir.
Where did all that oil come from, then?
Where, sir?
Down there.
Oh, I don't know, sir.
Looks like crankcase oil.
The car's been standing there.
Some time ago, though. The rain's washed it out, partly.
Like it washed away all the fingerprints on the gas mask bag, sir.
Certainly looks as if a car or a lorry's been standing here.
Could those be its tire marks?
Constable, see that no one that comes along here gets near those tire marks.
You want to make a plaster cast of them, sir?
Yes.
Well, Nobby Clark back at the station knows how to make them, sir. He was at the police college at Hendon.
I'll send him out when we go back. Have you covered everything else, McKinnon?
I think so, sir. Rain's washed away everything else, but I didn't notice these marks. Who's that?
Stop him, Constable, before he runs on those tire tracks.
Stop! Stop, stop! Please, stop.
Who is it, you know?
I think it's Miss Hartley. She's got the only MG in this park.
Who is she?
The daughter of our local retired colonel, Chief Air Raid Warden.
To learn about poor Philip, Superintendent. He was such a charming boy. What in the world are you doing out here?
This is the place where he was found, Miss Hartley.
Oh, how dreadful. You have my deepest sympathy, sir. Who's this man?
I'm Superintendent Lester of Scotland Yard, madam.
Now, don't call me madam. My name's Hartley. Inga Hartley. Lived here for years. My father's Colonel Hartley. Late the Green Howards. Been in the army practically all my life. Scotland Yard doing up here? Can't you handle this, Superintendent?
No,
from your nephew, of course, yes. Sorry. Who's had a lorry up here with a leaking crankcase?
We don't
tell a leaking crankcase, as far as I can see it. Who was it? The murderer?
sorry.
We've only just come in on this.
I saw a lorry over there at the road junction 3 mornings ago. Army lorry, driven by a lance corporal, driving onto the main road from this road.
Oh, was that the day the boy was reported missing, Superintendent? Was, huh? You're sure it was an army lorry, miss?
Hartley. Of course I know it was an army lorry, driven by a young lance corporal wearing steel-rimmed glasses, a 1,500-weight Fordson. I was raised in the army, sir, and I know what I see.
Was there any markings on it, Miss Hartley?
Of course. It was a Royal Corps of Signals lorry.
How did you know?
Why, it had the blue and white patch painted on the front like the signaler's armband. A big 56 was lettered on the side in white, and there was a red and green clover leaf painted on the left front door.
And the trucks of that signal convoy that passed through here...
Sir?
I remember the markings on them.
Card pips, that's right.
What, sir?
Yes, what are you talking about?
They were marked with playing card pips. Some of them with the ace of spades, some with diamonds and hearts
and... clubs.
There's your clover leaf, Miss Hartley.
God, stone the bloody crows. Excuse me, that's the murderer.
As Miss Hartley roared off in her MG, we headed for the village. It was a thin enough clue, but it was the only one, except for the mother's fantastic confession, but we started to investigate it at once. A telegram to the War Office.
Request most urgently present location of Royal Corps Signal Unit. Passed through this village 3 days ago, headed for East Coast Port. Information desired in connection with serious crime. Leicester, Scotland Yard.
No use trying to trace them any other way. Security regulations and all that.
We'll have a reply in no time, I'm sure.
But if that signal score corporal did kill him, why?
Probably struck him with the lorry and got frightened.
But what was Phyllis doing over there? The school's in the opposite direction.
Maybe he was running away.
Excuse me, sir. Would you like to have a look at the things we took from the boy's pockets?
Would you mind looking, Lester? If there's anything you think I should see...
I'll have a look, Constable.
He's a string, sir. An old cap badge. If that was his father, sir, he always carried it with him. Threepence and coppers. Half a packet of peppermints. Fair breaks your heart, doesn't it, sir? Poor kid.
Go on, Constable.
Khaki handkerchief.
Hold. Hold on a minute. Is that his?
Can't say, sir.
Hold it out. I think we'll take a... closer look at it. I believe that's oil on it there.
It is, sir. Smells like old crankcase oil to me, sir.
Hold it out. I'll tell you what to do with it. Might be quite important.
Yes, sir.
How's his mother?
Took her to a nursing home down the road, sir. She's, I'm afraid she's, you know, not going to get over it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, is that all?
Only this, sir.
What?
This we found inside the gas mask case, sir.
What is it?
Looks like the corner of a pound note, sir. All crumpled up. A bloody strange place to find a bit of money. How do you suppose he got it?
Why, I think, Constable, the important thing to discover is who has the rest of it.
The murderer.
Oh, hello, Isabel.
We've heard from the War Office about the signal company.
Where are they?
They're at a port of embarkation.
Oh.
They're due to leave the day after tomorrow for North Africa.
If we were to follow up what seemed to be a promising clue, in fact, our only clue, there was, of course, no time to lose. But there were things that we must accomplish before we left for the port of embarkation. And these are the things we accomplished with the aid of Scotland Yard technicians who were rushed to us from London.
We have the plaster casts of the tire marks on the road, sir. The samples of oil we took out of the mud are here, too.
They match the oil stains on the khaki handkerchief.
The handkerchief has been washed and examined. What appears to be a laundry mark, K201537, was discovered on the edge of it. It had been partially obscured by the oil stains.
The wound on the boy's throat was inflicted after death, which was caused by the blow on the head, sir.
One thing we do not know yet, Superintendent, is where that torn piece of the one-pound note came from.
I brought Philip's mother here to tell you about that.
It's from Philip's money box.
What?
I knew at once when my brother-in-law told me.
I took her home to see you.
Philip had come back and taken it. I looked in the drawer in his cupboard where he kept it. I found it broken open and empty. I knew what had been in it. 31 shillings in coin.
I always gave him a shilling for shining in my boots.
And the pound note I gave him for his birthday the day before Michaelmas. He'd taken it all to run away on. And they murdered him for 31 shillings and a pound note. The army paid me much more for his father.
I don't think I shall ever forget that.
We arrived at the barracks of the signal company at the port of embarkation shortly after Reveille. Major Hugh Scott, the young officer commanding, who had been an engineer at Wandsworth, was waiting for us in what he called his orderly room. The men were still at breakfast, but the company sergeant major ushered us in.
The gentleman from the police, sir.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Sergeant Major. Come in, gentlemen.
Thank you, Major.
Sit down, gentlemen. I'm afraid I don't know what this is all about, you know. I had an urgent message.
Yes, I'm afraid we shall have to cause you some inconvenience. This is a very serious matter.
Mm-hmm, I gathered that.
It involves murder, sir.
Mm, you're serious. What do you want me to do?
Answer some questions first, please, Major.
As well as I can. Right away.
Are all your men present?
Sergeant Major will know that. Sergeant Major!
Yes, sir?
All our people on hand, Sergeant Major.
All present at Reveille, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Well, they're all here, murderers included, if any.
You were encamped at the superintendent's village a few nights ago.
Right. He called on us.
That's correct.
You have one vehicle that has a bad leak in the crankcase.
How'd you know that?
Well, I'm asking you, sir.
We surely have. Our number 56 is acting up...
56 of 1,500 weight Fortson.
Well, I don't know how you know, but we're having more trouble with this monster
than
any...
And the markings on this lorry?
Well, the usual blue and white signals tab. And then there's the section marking on the front door.
What's it like, please?
An ace of clubs in red and green.
Ah. May we see the driver, please?
Of course. Sergeant Major again.
Yes, sir?
Send in Lance Corporal Latimer. Get him out of our palatial breakfast room, please.
Yes, sir.
He the murderer?
We'll see, I hope.
A mild-mannered bloke can't see him murdering anyone. Oh, you must be wrong.
You have a special laundry mark for your company, Major?
Laundry mark? Well, hardly in this man's army.
We found one on this khaki handkerchief.
Might be anyone's, old chap. I have one myself.
It was in the murdered boy's pocket.
Boys? Oh, good Lord, gentlemen, do you... Yes?
Latimer, sir.
Come in, Latimer.
Lance Corporal Latimer, sir.
Stand easy, Latimer. What makes you jingle so, Corporal?
Jingle, sir?
Ring like bow bells.
Oh, that's shillings, sir. I've got a pocket full of shillings. Excuse me, sir.
Never mind, Corporal. Where did you get those shillings?
Why, sir, I...
Answer anything these gentlemen ask you, Latimer, they're policemen.
Oh. I got them from my mate, sir.
Who's he?
Signaller Ruling, sir.
Sergeant Major!
Yes, sir?
Send for Ruling.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Major Scott.
Yeah, that's quite right.
Where did he get them?
I don't know, sir.
Latimer, is this your handkerchief?
Looks like mine, sir. May I see it, please? Yes, sir. Here's the laundry mark they put on it when we were stationed at Leeds, sir. K201537. Yes, sir, that's mine.
Where did you lose it?
Lose it, sir? I didn't lose it. My pal had it. I lent it to him.
Ruling?
Yes, sir.
Sure?
Yes, sir, I'm sure.
Do you always wear those steel-rimmed glasses, Latimer?
Yes, sir. Always.
Wearing them when you met the lady in the MG the other morning?
What morning, sir?
When you turned off the side road onto the main road. When you were at the camp before the last one.
I never saw a lady up there, sir. I wasn't even out of the camp.
The morning
You stopped your lorry on the by road and stayed there a few minutes?
I never left the camp, sir.
Your lorry was out, I think.
I wouldn't know, sir. I was working on the generator truck all day, sir.
Alone, no doubt.
Alone? Yes, sir.
Look at this. You know what it is?
Looks like slabs of plaster, sir.
They are plaster casts of tire marks left by your lorry at a certain place, Latimer.
I don't think they could be, sir. The lorry wasn't in a certain place.
What certain place?
Where you sit, sir.
You can easily prove it by comparing these casts with your tires.
Well, sir, if it was where you said it was, it wasn't me driving it.
Where did I say it was?
Well, I don't know, sir.
Latimer.
One moment, please, Major. Latimer, do you recognize this? Do you know what it is?
No, sir. A red satchel.
It was the boy's gas mask case.
I never saw it before in all my life, sir. I'll take my bloody oath to that. What boys, sir?
Oh, blast. Come in. What is it, Sergeant Major?
Sorry, sir.
What?
Ruling's missing, sir. I think he's gone over the hill.
Major Scott got the military police on the track of the missing signaler ruling at once. We wanted to see him badly enough, but Major Scott had reasons of his own. Desertion from a post in wartime is also a very serious matter. While a Red Cap MP lieutenant, a former Berkshire constabulary sergeant, assured the Major that they'd very soon find the adjectived rascal, the superintendent and I went out to compare our plaster cast with the tires on lorry number 56. They matched perfectly. We returned to the orderly room to find the policeman gone and Major Scott sitting staring at the contents of Ruling's kit.
Look here at these clothes, gentlemen.
They're soaking wet.
Perhaps they were the ones he wore when it was raining then.
They could very well be, if he did it.
I didn't do it.
Yes, you said that, Latimer.
Look. Here's something on the cuff of this jacket.
Where?
Look here. What's this? Looks like blood.
He said he cut his hand.
Did he?
He didn't show me the cut, sir.
Then you don't know.
No, sir.
What kind of chap is this man Ruling, anyway?
Well, he's a great husky young fella.
And he wears steel-rimmed glasses, just like I do.
He does.
Sir, I was just thinking.
What?
Well, when I came back to my bivvy after working on the generator lorry all day, I had a look at 56.
And?
Well, she was awfully muddy. Much muddier than the other lorries that had been standing in the park all day.
Could someone have taken her out without your knowing it?
Could they, Latimer?
Would be possible, sir.
Ruling?
Well, sir, he's supposed to be my pal.
But what?
He was always drifting off, I remember. Alone.
What for?
Well, he always liked to visit people in the business, he said.
What business?
The business he was in before he was called up.
What'd he do?
He was a butcher.
The MPs brought signaler Ruling back at 3 the next morning. They had found him, they said, standing in front of a... you guess what kind of shop. He was quite self-possessed as he stood in Major Scott's office.
Stand easy, Ruling. These gentlemen want to talk to you, Ruling.
Aye, sir.
I think they want to ask you some questions.
First, we want to search this man, Major.
Go ahead.
I'll look at your wallet first, Ruling.
Aye, sir. Not much in it, sir.
We'll see.
Yes, sir.
I opened the wallet. There was nothing in it at all. Nothing except a torn £1 note. Give me the torn piece of Phillips' pound note, I said to the superintendent. That was all. It fitted perfectly.
Let me do it. Lewis Ruling, I arrest you for the willful murder of Philip Ainsley Avery.
Aye, sir.
And I warn you that anything you say will be taken down in writing and may be used in evidence.
Ah, I'm not afraid to tell you about it, sir. I killed poor little beggar. He said he was running away to join army. I laughed at him, and he told me he had plenty of money. And I asked him where he kept it. He said in his respirator case, and I reached for it and he yelled. Just like one of them little lambs when you've got it by its neck. And I got mad. And he jumped out of the lorry, and I after him, and he turned to yell at me, and I hit him with a spanner, just like a cute little lamb. And then he fell down, and I did what you always do to a lamb when you kill it.
Lewis Rowling was tried and found guilty of the murder of the poor little lamb. But his counsel appealed on the grounds of insanity, and he was adjudged mentally irresponsible. He was committed to an institution for the criminal insane and died there more than a year ago.
You have heard another authentic story from the files of Scotland Yard on Whitehall 1212. Research is prepared by Percy Hoskins of the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper. Three chimes mean good times on NBC.
That's Whitehall 1212 from January 27, 1952, with the murder of little Philip Avery. That was heard on NBC. Hope you enjoyed that. All right, Lisa, it's time now for the conclusion, part five of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. You ready for that?
Well, we need part five. We've heard one through four. You can't leave us hanging.
No, I don't want to do that. This is the Shepherd Matter. Here's the conclusion now to yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
This is the hotel operator, Mr. Dollar. Were you cut off?
Don't
tell him to let any more calls in here. Come on!
I was cut off, but I'd rather get some sleep now. Anybody phones, just take a message.
All right, Mr. Dollar.
Over there. Sit down. Put your hands on your knees. Now, just so as you and I understand each other, you make one move. Wiggle a finger, I'll empty this gun right in your stomach. You understand me?
I understand you, Forbes. You're crazy.
Tonight, and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Richard Porter, 480 Webster Boulevard, Providence, Rhode Island. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Shepherd matter. I was pretty sick of it and with it when I had Paul Forbes visit me in my hotel room about 7 o'clock in the morning. He used a gun in front of me once before to crack my skull. I decided I'd try to avoid that again. So I sat down and I played good. It didn't seem to please him a bit.
You were up to my house about an hour ago, weren't you?
Yeah, I went out to talk to your wife.
Yeah, I saw you. I was across the street watching. I followed you here. Fixing up another deal, huh?
I don't know what you're talking about, Forbes.
I followed you here so we could have a little talk. And we're going to have it, you and I.
You ought to put that gun away and let them take you, Forbes.
Where do you live?
In Hartford, Connecticut.
I mean, where do you live in town here in Providence?
I don't. I live in Hartford.
Where do you practice?
Practice what?
Are you trying to get funny with me?
I don't practice anything here in Providence. I don't live here. I'm just here for a few days.
Doing what?
Working on an insurance matter.
Insurance matter? You're licensed to practice law in Rhode Island?
Oh, you've got something all wrong, Forbes. I don't practice law. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an insurance investigator. I tried to tell you that yesterday morning when you cracked me with that gun. I was called in by Dr. Shepherd. He said you threatened his life.
You're lying to me. Shepard called me yesterday morning, said a lawyer named Dollar was on his way over to talk to me about giving Pauline a divorce. You're a lawyer.
I'm what I say I am. If you hadn't started swinging that gun butt around, I'd have told you why I was there yesterday.
You got a billfold or something?
My coat pocket inside on the back of that chair there. I think I know why Shepard called you and told you I was a lawyer. I think he wanted you to attack me and make me...
Shut up! You and Shepard are trying to pull something to take my wife away from me. I know that much. And now you're trying to pull something to get out of this jam.
You're wrong, Forbes. I don't know anything about trying to take your wife away from you.
You know I didn't kill Shepard.
How do I know you didn't kill him? You threatened him. Half a dozen people have attested to that. I know you had a reason to kill him. I know every time I've seen you, you had a gun in your hands and you've been swinging it at somebody, particularly me.
You know who did it. You're in on it somewhere. You know who killed Shepard, and you're going to clear me. You're going to tell me, Dollar. I'm going to whip it out of you. You're going crazy.
All right. Get on your feet. He sat in the chair just the way I propped him there. His eyes looked dull and lifeless as though he were already dead. I couldn't think of anything brilliant to say or do, so I rummaged around my suitcase and pulled out a bottle. Then I found a pair of glasses in the bathroom and poured a couple of drinks. When I came on out, he hadn't moved from the chair. He looked crumpled like a worn-out suit of clothes. He made no effort to look at me when I tucked the glass in his hand. Here, try this. Go on, drink it.
Why don't you call the police?
Now you say you followed me here to have a talk and find out what's what. Now's the time to talk, pal. This thing isn't the best conversation piece in the world.
Leave me alone. Call him in.
You have something going for you here. This gun hasn't been fired. Do you have another one?
No. No, Dollar, I didn't kill Dr. Shepard. I wanted to more than anything in the world. But I didn't kill him.
Now look, I want some facts. So let's start with last night. Where were you when Shepard was shot?
How do I know where I was? I don't even know what time he was shot.
All right, let's start with yesterday morning. You slugged me, ran out of the house, jumped in a car, and what happened? Go on, take it from there.
I drove over to Dr. Shepard's office. I was going to have it out with him. He was breaking up my home.
Well, go on. Did you see him?
No. I parked down the street from his office, and then I saw him jump in his car, and I followed him. Came back over here. I knew my wife must have called him to take care of you.
What happened then?
I went over to the park and sat and tried to figure things out. You don't know what I've been through this past year.
All right, go on.
Then I went to a bar. I was hungry. I hadn't eaten all day. I got a couple of sandwiches and then I had some drinks. I don't know how many. Anyhow, the more I drank, the more hopeless everything looked.
Did you call Shepard?
Yeah. Yeah, I called him from the bar.
Any idea what time it was?
Must have been around 5 or 6. What difference does it all make? I'm cooked and you know it.
Go on, will you? You called Shepard, then what did you do?
I told him I wanted to talk to him about everything that had happened. I told him where to meet me.
You mean you wanted Dr. Shepard to come down and meet you so you could kill him?
Maybe I did have that in my mind. I don't know. On the phone, he sounded so calm and said we could talk it out and straighten it out like gentlemen.
Did you talk to him?
No. I didn't see him at all. I waited an hour and he never showed up. I called his office back and the answering service said everyone had gone out for the day and I didn't know what to do. I got back in my car and turned on the radio and that's where I heard I was wanted for murder. Dollar, I didn't do it. I swear I didn't. I had reason enough, but I didn't. I knew all about the others, but this was serious.
Wait a minute. What others?
Pauline's always had other friends. Friends. I guess... I don't know. I don't guess I love her anymore. I don't know. I don't think she ever loved me. But I needed her. I needed her more than anything this last year or so. And at times I did love her the way it once was. And I found out what was going on between her and Shepard. She wanted a divorce. I wouldn't give her a divorce. If I had let her and Shepard get away with it,
would have been too much to take, to ask.
Oh, this doesn't make sense. Even though you didn't love her and she didn't love you, you wouldn't stand still for a divorce action? It sounds stupid.
I just told you. I needed her so much this last year or so. So much.
Still doesn't make any sense, Forbes. Why didn't you let her go?
She knew she didn't have to divorce me. She knew it wouldn't be too long.
What?
Shepard gave me a year. Another doctor in Baltimore, 18 months. Leukemia. Don't you see? She would have been free. They could have waited until I was dead, at least. Just that, until I was dead. Couldn't they? Well, couldn't they?
Expense account item 10, $2, sleeping pills. I fed them to him along with a cup of hot chocolate. He looked pretty worn out, and within 15 minutes, he was sound asleep in my bed. Item 11, $4.16, one long-distance phone call to a Baltimore clinic where I spoke with a Dr. Franz Mueller. Dr. Mueller confirmed what Forbes had said. Forbes was doomed with an incurable ailment. Item 12, $0.20, another phone call, this one from the hotel lobby to the coroner's office. I learned that Shepard had been killed by 32 caliber slugs. Forbes' gun, a 32, had not been fired or hastily cleaned. His story was checking out. That left just one small item to be cleared up. Expense account item 13, $4. Taxi fare from my hotel back to the Oakdale home. Special rates for nurses.
Hello. I thought you'd be back to see me. Somehow I'm glad it's you, Mr. Dollar.
Go ahead.
It's an old story. Terribly old and corny. I applied for a job as Dr. Shepard's nurse 5 years ago, and I fell in love with him that very day. I've loved him every day from that time on. 5 years.
Go on.
I don't know when it was, when he started up with Mrs. Forbes. I knew she was trying to get a divorce. I knew Mr. Forbes wouldn't stand for it. Then one day, last week I guess it was, I heard Doctor talking to her on the phone. He said, there's a way to get rid of him. I knew he was talking about getting rid of Mr. Forbes.
Did they discuss the part about Shepard getting Forbes to threaten his life in front of witnesses so he could shoot him down when the time came?
No, I didn't know that until yesterday morning. So long ago, it seems. You came to see Doctor and then you left. I overheard him on the phone again. He called up Mr. Forbes and said Mr. Dollar was coming over to talk about the divorce action.
And he knew Forbes would be upset enough to attack me.
Doctor was very good about anticipating what people would do in given situations. Even me. I was in the office when Mr. Forbes called last night. I saw Doctor put the gun in his coat. I knew he was going down to meet Mr. Forbes and shoot him, so I followed him. He was walking around in the dark looking for Mr. Forbes with a gun in his hand. I ran up to him and pleaded with him not to be crazy, that Mrs. Forbes wasn't worth it. Then he said he was going to kill me, too. We struggled. The gun went off. I don't know how many times.
I can help you, Corinne. You didn't mean to kill him. He meant to shoot you. When all these other details come out, the most they can charge you with is second-degree justifiable or manslaughter.
No. You're nice. But I can't get off.
Huh?
I guess the police haven't found her yet. I went over and killed Mrs. Forbes an hour ago.
Expense account item 14, same as item 1, transportation back to Hartford. The next time you have a doubtful insurance application, Mr. Porter, settle it yourself or call someone else. Don't call me. As far as I can add up, and I'm not going to recheck the figures, expense account total is $485. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Now, here's our star to tell you about next week's intriguing story.
Next week, the case of a lonely heart that found plenty of company in the nearest morgue. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by John Dawson, it is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone. Heard in this week's cast were Gene Bates, Virginia Gregg, Russell Thorson, Parley Bear, Herb Ellis, Barney Phillips, and Lawrence Dobkin. Musical supervision by Amerigo Marino. Be sure to join us on Monday night, same time and station, for another exciting story of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
That's yours truly, Johnny Dollar, from April 20th, 1956. Part 5, the conclusion of the Shepherd Matter, starring Bob Bailey. Hope you enjoyed that. Let's take a quick break, then it's more here on the WGN Radio Theater. Well, Lisa, what's on next week?
Oh, well, next week we have some more great classic radio. Fancy that. We've got Dragnet, Burns and Allen, Gunsmoke, Suspense, the Damon Runyon Theater, and another five-part story of yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Are you going to be here?
Looks like I will.
I hope so.
Unless you throw me out into the other room again.
No, I'll stay by the
microphone.
Need you here. All right, folks, thanks for listening. Thanks for staying safe out there. And we'll see you next week right here on WGN at 10 p.m. for the WGN Radio Theater.